Hello, I'm Jeff Roberts, interviewing longtime Alaskan aviator Emmett Goldeen. Emmett has a chapter dedicated to his life and recently written Heroes of the Horizon by Jerry Bruder. First question is, when and where were you born?
I was born in Skagway, Alaska on October 14, 1924, just 70 years ago.
What brought your family to Alaska?
Oh, it was building of the Great Basin Yukon Railroad. The railroad from Skagway to Whitehorse. My grandfather brought a team of workers from Seattle somewhere in 1898 or 99 to work on the railroad. I guess the railroad asked him to do that. Actually, I don't know how they contacted him because he was from the east. Just like all the gold seekers, he was from Seattle. He wasn't looking for gold, though. He was just plain old contractor, and we moved there and started a family. The first one in the family was born in 1900, an uncle who just died last year. And then there were six total in the family.
Hello, I'm Jeff Roberts, interviewing longtime Alaskan aviator Emmett Goldeen. Emmett has a chapter dedicated to his life and recently written Heroes of the Horizon by Jerry Bruder. First question is, when and where were you born?
I was born in Skagway, Alaska on October 14, 1924, just 70 years ago.
What brought your family to Alaska?
Oh, it was building of the Great Basin Yukon Railroad. The railroad from Skagway to Whitehorse. My grandfather brought a team of workers from Seattle somewhere in 1898 or 99 to work on the railroad. I guess the railroad asked him to do that. Actually, I don't know how they contacted him because he was from the east. Just like all the gold seekers, he was from Seattle. He wasn't looking for gold, though. He was just plain old contractor. And we moved there and started a family. The first one in the family was born in 1900, an uncle who just died last year. And then there were six total in the family, three girls and three boys. My mom was the second oldest. She was born in 1901, and I was born 24. And my kids were born in 55. Grandkids were 70. Four generations, anyway.
Okay. Did your family have any encounters with Soapy Smith, the outlaw from Skagway?
No, not actually. Because Mom wasn't born until after he was supposedly shot by the marshal. No, that was before the family arrived. Well, I guess Grandma and Grandpa were there, but I never did talk to them about it.
Okay. What was life like in Skagway growing up, and how did the Depression affect that part of Alaska?
Actually, the Depression didn't really hit Alaska like nowadays. It hits America, and Alaska survives, and later Alaska gets it, and the state survives. It was typical of the time. We had electricity and water. A lot of people thought we didn't have those sort of things nowadays, but we always had electricity and water. Cold houses in the winter time because they weren't designed or built for the cold. Lots of wind. Skagway is known for its wind. It blows from the south in the summer and from the north in winter. And the Depression actually, we were living in Tacoma for about a year, 28 and 29. And I wasn't very old, but I do remember coming back to Alaska after the crash in October. We came and back to Skagway in December. Maybe there was a Russian airplane. You can always tell. They smoke up the sky. And Dad couldn't find any work in Seattle or Tacoma, so he came back to Skagway and went right to work at the railroad, where he'd worked before.
Did he continue working with the railroad then?
Yeah, he remained with the railroad until he retired. He was section foreman and later B&B foreman, when he retired as a B&B foreman, built all the bridges and houses and everything on the railroad.
So that railroad, that was kind of unique for the amount of elevation that it gained in short periods of time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was real steep for railroads, fairly steep grade. 4%, I think, is one number I remember in one section that they had to get up there quick.
So
the first 20 miles, it goes to nearly 2,000 feet. Winds them up and down canyons to get there.
Such a real feat in engineering for the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sure was. It was something else in those days.
So the depression really didn't affect Alaska like it did other parts of the country. Then it kind
we didn't have the problem with food that we did in Tacoma. I remember Mom would go picking berries and stuff and get to keep track of them. We didn't have much meat on the table. We were pretty hungry. And when we got back to Alaska, then it was easier to survive. I mean, we had lots of food. Especially when Mom worked for the railroad, and they always had good food for them.
And so you got some of that at home?
Well, no, we lived on the railroad in the summer.
Okay.
And in the winter, we lived in the camp. But there was always good food there. Nothing fresh, like vegetables, but always had some basic and money to buy it. That was a big thing during the Depression. The food was there, but nobody could buy it. We didn't have any problem with it.
Did your family was real close to the railroads. How did you end up getting into aviation rather than with the railroad side?
Well, that was because I watched those two pieces of iron going over the hill, and everybody's tired of those two pieces of iron going over the hill. And I said, "Hey, I want to do something else." And the first time I saw an airplane, I decided that's for me.
How old were you when you first remember any contact with?
Probably about 8 years old. An old airplane flew through the town, well, up the valley there, and went back out with Savoy Machete, owned by Tony Schwamm. And it wound its days up on the beach just north of Juneau. He sort of left on the beach and just rotted away. It wasn't really much of an airplane anyway, as far as being commercially useful. It didn't carry much of a load. But it has quite a history. The airplane was flown from Italy, a whole armada of them was flown all back in the 30s to some sort of a convention or something to New York. And they sold them all here in America. I don't know how they ever got across the ocean like that, but they did. And they scattered them around America, and one of them did wind up in Juneau. That's my first airplane I saw. And after that, I read on magazines and built models. And then the airplane finally came to town probably in about 1935. We're in Bookwater. Now the first in Skagway was fiscal plane. Clyde Warren brought it in, and he had a pilot named Slim Menifee that flew it. And we just tour tops and a little bit of flying into White House. And of course, I hung around close as I could, but a 10-year-old kid, they don't want to be close to the airplane.
Is that kind of special curiosity with airplanes and sort of fascination with flying?
Right. It was like railroads were to the West. In the 1800s, you look for the kids look for the most exciting thing in their life. And airplanes became my life.
When you were 15, that's when Hitler started taking over countries in Europe. Did you have a real opinion of what he was doing, or was it not real big news in Alaska?
I got memories of a couple of Germans. Young fellows came up on the railroad, and they were hiking over the railroad in the late 30s. And I knew, of course, we had a heck of a good school the teacher was really strong in history, Lottie Gaffey, and so we were abreast of all of the activities over there. Yeah, we were aware of the German invasions and oppressions. And these two young fellas, years later, I got thinking about it. Were they sent up to spy, or what were they doing there? Were they trying to escape Germany? We're definitely German young fellas. Yeah, we knew about it. That talk of it. My natural dad was in World War I, and that was a war to shut down the Germans, which didn't work. They came back. My natural dad died when I was two, so I never really had any opportunity to hear his side of the war situation. He was gassed in the trenches and died of lungs gave out on him. And I think it was about 1926, and I don't really know. And Mom married my stepdad, which really my dad, because I grew up with him. A sweet milk. Sweet old sweet.
Did you ever believe that America would get involved overseas, stopping the Germans? Or do you do that
I was pretty young, and there was so much newspaper baloney about we're going to stay out of this war, and we don't belong in this war, and there were so many Germans in our country that they kind of didn't want to have too much of an opinion in the paper and the government. It took the Japanese to get us really involved. We were mentally involved pretty much before that, but we couldn't get physically involved because of the in America we were
the isolationism.
Yeah, we had people for the British and we had people against the British, and they had many Germans that it was hard to really get us into it in the beginning. We were in it because we built all kinds of stuff for the British, but it was the same old story that they're talking out two sides of their mouth. But when Japs attacked, then it was very simple. Germany declared war on us, which a lot of people don't realize. We didn't declare war on them. We declared war on Japan, and then Germany fallen through, but that's the thing that turned the tide. And it made good sense. Everything went the right way. Everybody, it was a popular war. We were hard to convince that we've got to go one way. We either got to support the Germans or the British. And when the Japs attacked, and the Germans declared war, it was no problem. From then on, we knew where we were going to go.
Do you remember what you were doing at the time that Pearl Harbor was bombed?
Oh yeah, I sure do. Well, it was Sunday, and we heard it got bombed, so we had a meeting at school, and the whole town met. The biggest place they had there, and I was in high school then, senior high, and so they decided, well, the military had sent a message up to provide a guard for the communications building. There's only one little stack, about 30 foot square. They had a radio in there and antennas, and that was the only communication out of that. So they asked the town to set up a home guard around that 24 hour day until they could get the military up there to take over the guard duty. Well, I wound up 4 to 8 in the morning with a guy named Lee Gulp. They took one kid and one adult and put them together. And we stood guard cold as well. It's very interesting. People now don't realize what little we knew about the Japanese. Now they got this deal in Smithsonian where they're whitewashing the Japs and blackballing the Americans. And we were other people. They weren't there at the time. We didn't know the Japs weren't coming up the canal because Skagway was a key point in Alaska. And heck, they knew more about Alaska than we did. We found out later. They had pictures and details of a lot of things. But we didn't know. We guarded that Radio Shack, and I can remember watching over the hill where if there'd been airplanes where they would have come from. And of course, you watched the water, it was right down on the waterfront. If there'd been anything unusual, all we'd have done is get the guy, radio man, to send a message out.
How long did it take to, how long did it take for the military to?
It was a week, 1 week later, the military, they sent a contingency up from Haines that did all the guarding from then on.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they came in later with a group of waterfront guards. Because there's a lot of shipping going on. Even before the Japs bombed, we had a lot of shipping going through Skagway. That's the only way to get the stuff to interior.
Did you go into the military then right after high school?
No, I was 17, none of them signed the papers for me, so I couldn't get in until I drafted me at 18. And I didn't get in until 44. And I went to the Air Force because I had a little knowledge of aviation, but by then they had more pilots than they could handle, so there was no way of getting pilot training in the Air Force. I became a mechanic, which was good. I had some real good training. Couldn't afford it from the outside. I always wanted to go to school, but the school was very expensive, and I didn't even have a dream of doing it.
So you sort of got a free education.
Correct.
In the service.
Yeah, sure did.
When did you get married then? When did you get married?
I got married September 1st, 1948.
Okay.
And that only lasted 10 years.
Were you working in Alaska at the time?
No, at the time I just got out of service. And I was getting my mechanics license at San Francisco and working in Chico for an old buddy. An old guy that I met there. I'm just trying to make a living, and it was kind of exciting right after the war in aviation down there. Surplus airplanes that you couldn't even dream of getting a chance to fly, and suddenly you can buy them for nothing. And the guys were buying BT-13s for $600 or $800, and that's all the money they had, didn't have enough money to put gas in. Beautiful airplanes. And P-51, my brother-in-law bought one of those in 1955. For $800.
Wow.
Which is real nice, and I went down the license and flew it around a bit. 55, but that was quite a bit after the war.
So you were flying, I think in Jerry Bruder's book, said you were flying up to Canada at the time. You were flying from California to Canada, is that correct? You were flying bees or something?
That was a long time later.
Okay.
Yeah, I was flying co-pilot in C-46. And no big capital passengers. Must have been about a billion, I guess. We had the airplane was just totally stacked with boxes of bees, honeybees. And we just had a little aisle down to the center that we go up to stand in. And there's honeybees all over, everywhere. They hide outside of the boxes. The boxes are designed for the queen, two queens in a box, and they'd hive on each side. And then they close the lid down. But they just keep hiving on the outside. So we had almost as many outside as we had in. And nobody ever got stung there. It's amazing. If you look at a wasp, it scares the hell out of me. But those honeybees are just so docile. They'd be on the controls, they'd reach for the throttle, and you push them a little bit. So he didn't know. If you heard him, he'd bite you.
Shoot them out of the way. So, also, Fearless of the Horizon by Jerry Bruder mentions an incident of a forced landing in 1949, I guess, of a CB.
Oh.
And I think there's a gas line that was cut.
No, it was
oil.
The oil went out. And I just accidentally noticed it. I just want to think you don't realize how much you do watch for things. Afterwards, I thought, how come I recognize that? I'd just taken off my journal and was heading down somewhere down to Petersburg, and I just got out on the rough water, and the gauge started slipping. And then it immediately turned around for a shelter spot, and It's not very far from down, I think. They eat this thing to lose more on its own park behind Norman Island. And what it was, the guy, mechanic the night before, for some reason, got playing with a prop, took it off, and it was an O-ring that was really delicate, about 4-inch size O-ring. And when he put it back together, he nipped a little hunk out of that O-ring. So the oil pressure went right on by the prop control. The prop was out and back, so I didn't know it. The back end was all covered with oil. As soon as I called in, that guy that fit over the prop knew what had happened. So he came out with a new seal. And meanwhile, he came out and that thing, my fluid back on the CD back there.
So that didn't take long to lose all that oil pressure since it was just spraying out the pack?
Not 10 miles. And took off to it, it's gone.
No time to turn around.
Yeah, but it's quite common at the CD. A lot of, in fact, later they put a mirror out on the strut. In fact, they use CBUC. Nowadays, it's got a mirror out there on the float strut, so you can look at the back and see the oil. No.
Hopefully not the oil.
There were two problems. The top was one, and they had a Panarchy fuel pump that would leak, diaphragm would leak and suck engine oil overboard. That was a bad deal. Better than that.
At what point did you start, did you begin working with the Fish and Wildlife then?
February 1953. I always wanted to work for O'Brien. I asked Gorman one day, he said, yep, I need you. I worked as a mechanic the first 6 months, but then it was a job to work into pilot, because all pilots in the Fish and Wildlife were pilot mechanics in those days. They had to be mechanics. But then, the first year that I checked out in the region, and I was just looking at my log book. Clarence checked me out in March in the Goose of 1955. Yeah. I'd been trying to wait him, but I hadn't checked out the Goose yet. So then that started me in the Goose. Finally, I've been working on this mechanical coastal for a year.
So what sorts of jobs did they have you doing then for them?
Well, actually, more like a taxi driver, bus driver, to do survey work, and take guys along with me. I always had somebody with me. They were surveyors, or they may be a game warden. We had some interesting trips, chasing people down, and take the game warden with me. We went to Kennedy one time to try to find out if they were selling deer meat in the restaurant there, of all dumb things. But they were chasing all these things. And we stopped and had lunch there just to check the meat, see if it was wild meat that they were selling on the counter. And they weren't. Rhubarb, good rhubarb. I was flying nothing. And we called they'd catch groups down at Homer, put them on PMA, ship to Juneau, and we'd keep them in a little cage we had there, and then we'd fly them out to the island on Prince of Wales Island. No, it was the Burnoff Island we took. And I guess there's quite a population now, but it was pretty sad. We'd lose about 2/3 of them. They just died. One died right in my arms. Picked him up out of the airplane and was going to pack him up into the woods, and he gave a couple of gas and he was dead.
Trauma. Was he being caged up in the...
Well, it wasn't, they weren't that caged up. It was just a trauma of people dealing with him. And they were tranquilized, and that might have been a problem too. I worked in Seattle in the transplant, and our first Seattle transplant in 19 with a state, Magoose, in 65, year after the quake. We'd take 10 Seattle tracks, and each one has in a pen. And the first two trips we took down to like Pelican. We lost about 3/4 of them. They tranquilized them, put them in the box, and about 2 hours later we dumped them out. It was a lot of loss. It was real sad. But now, it didn't take long to find out what was wrong. We weren't putting water on. They needed to be wet, but they were afraid at that time to get them wet because they stopped and make their hair mess with the flow. But it's not so. They found out later. So we developed the first successful transplant to Seattle. So they used to do someone, my shipboard did, put them on the ship and take them south, but they didn't survive too well. And my buddy just spent this year doing it again. I just kind of developed the whole process. All I was a taxi driver, really. All I provided was transportation. But to get really involved in some of the projects, catching fishermen out in Bristol Bay was kind of an interesting one. We used to catch the real bandits. We'd play a cat and mouse game with them. They were cagey. Those guys knew that they'd been out longer than I had by far. One 4th of July, caught 40 of them out there. The fog just started lifting, and they were all above the line in illegal water. And I was able to
fly low enough. Yeah.
Fly low enough, catch the numbers. We got 40 of them. We got convictions of all the two of them, and they said not guilty. And a year later, they went to court. And old Wendell P.K. was there for free lawyer, and we had some typical dim-witted district attorneys who just come out of law school and didn't know to hunt from their back. And we lost that one. But we were pretty lucky. We won most of them. And it wasn't a case of trying to persecute anybody. They were in the wrong. They were illegal. And that's it. But the damn attorneys can make it look like you don't know what you're talking about. Well, how do you know your compass is right? I don't need a goddamn compass. Well, you're supposed to have a compass. Oh, boy. And then he'd ask the fisherman, how does your compass work? Oh, it hasn't worked in 5 years. I don't know. So he'd say, okay, that fisherman doesn't have a compass working. You don't either. You can't prove he was in that area. Hey, I know where he was. I can see the markers. I can see him. So
that just seems like a weasel their way out of some of these.
I'm sure they
did. Now, you worked also for the Bureau of Land Management.
2 years, yeah. I flew firefighters. We get a call for fire and pile in about 4 or 5 of those guys with all their gear. Man, they fill up the goose. And then we'd take them out over the fire, and they always had a jump master that he'd light up front with me and tell me where he wanted me to be and what minimum speed and altitude. He'd tell me what he wanted, and I just do it, and out they go.
You have to fly pretty low to get these guys sort of right into where they're supposed to be, don't you?
They're below 1,000 feet.
Okay.
Generally, it's about 1,500 feet, generally. Any lower than that, they might be in trouble. And it was a hilly country almost. It wasn't like dropping in a flat meadow. We used to practice up in Fairbanks in the flat meadow, which was a piece of cake. But when you get out in the real life, it's mountainous, and they want to get on a certain ridge, and you've got to figure the wind, because you can see that from the fire. And the jump master, he's a pretty smart guy. He knows all about what's going on. And you just do as he tells you.
That's pretty dangerous work for the small jumpers, isn't it?
Well, it's up here, it isn't so bad. Down in America, it's pretty rough. They have the tremendous force. Up here, a lot of times, it's just a waste of effort, just brush fires. I mean, the timber is nothing.
Okay.
So it's not, I don't remember if it's ever losing any smoke chambers. I can't remember from jumping or from smoke or anything. I don't remember ever of ever losing a smoke chamber on the ground or in the air. They had a real good loss when I was flying. There was only a couple of years after. That was fun. Now, that was another thing that got involved with cadastral engineers. We used to call them catastrophic engineers. They do surveys of all the country around here. When data come along, the federal government was charged with doing a lot of surveying, telling Alaska where the boundaries were. And I'd fly these guys out into lakes and rivers and all over Alaska. Again, it was just kind of like a glorified cab driver with a hell of a nice airplane. And all the gas I could put in.
Are you an advocate of Alaska statehood? And how do you feel about the federal government's attitude toward the treatment of Alaska as a territory?
Well, Alaska's always, in my opinion, been well treated by the federal government. I voted against statehood in 1959 while I was in battle searching for my boss, Terrence Rhodes, who was born 21 years later. And my dad voted for statehood. So he was in favor. We canceled each other's vote. I didn't think we were ready for it, but who knows, really. Looking back, it was stupid of me to ever vote against it, because it's here and it's going to happen. And the federal government has always babysat Alaska, in my opinion. We've got welfare, we've got native support, we've got so many federally sponsored programs to keep everybody alive in Alaska. In fact, I always kind of felt BLM's job was just to give Alaska money. We'd fight fires that were so stupid. They wouldn't. We fought one northeast of Fort Yukon for about 2 weeks, and then they decided to pull off. Well, we didn't have any other fires, so what the hell, let's go back on that fire and put it out. Well, went back for about another month and fiddled with it, and I flew the last crews out of there, and there were still fires working up around it, but there was nothing to burn, nothing but muskets. Northeast 75, we called it. What do you find Northeast 75? The fires were always identified by their location from a known point, like Burmax Northwest 10, be out there in the foothills, or Fairbanks South 20, and just cost a bundle of money to supply it and take guys in and feed them. And we needed a warehouse, and they blew more money on that stupid fire than the warehouse would have cost.
But they kept you employed and they gave you a nice aircraft.
Right, yep. Yeah, look at it. Right, it was total waste. It kept the environment up. Heck, I had a nice job, nice equipment. And with FAA, it was a little different. It's really something there to do to maintain the airway facility, make sure that they're working properly. Nowadays, don't even need to worry about it. They got equipment so much superior to what we had, what they had, the ground people had in those days. Now we don't go flight check, it's just kind of a formality. In those days we had to keep on top of it, flight check. That's when Grandpa was chief maintenance out there and head of electronics, and then later years he was editing the whole thing.
When were you hired on by the FAA then?
December 5th, 1965. I was flying for the state fish and game, gooses and cubs and whatever they had. And in September, somebody says, hey, do you want to go to work? Yeah, I said, yeah. I've had my name in there since 1960. I'm ready. Okay, well, need pilots to learn. Even get your board. So it took until the 5th of December before they could. Officially came. I was actually, I had a government rating already with Fish and Wildlife and BLM, GS rating, so it wasn't a problem as far as getting me into the system. I was already in it. But getting an opening was a big problem. So I quit the fishing game and went to real fun, DC 3.
Where were you residing when the earthquake struck?
Oh, right in the middle of it. I was in Turnington. I was in Marston Drive. It was one of the areas that we all got 100% destroyed. And got a lot of tax money back from that. Previous years, I'd made pretty good and paid a lot of tax. So I lived for about a year on tax returns.
So your whole house was just
I was destroyed.
Were you actually in the area then?
No, I was in the middle field working.
Okay.
And my family was in the house when it started shaking, but I had a friend, Ray Loshi, was visiting, and he was going out hunting, but he was going to spend a couple of days with us, and thank God he was there, because as soon as it started shaking, he was in the living room with the kids. He said, "Come on, kids, let's get the hell out of here," and then went out the back door. And luckily, the front end went down, but the backyard stayed up. But it opened up like a plowed field, and the old house fell into it, which is the best thing that could have happened to one of Wally Hickel's abortions. It was one of Wally Hickel's $1 million deal. Piece of junk for a house.
Well, yeah. You mentioned Cornish Rhodes.
Yeah.
So that was. Now, you were pretty involved with the search for him then.
I was on King Salmon when it started. It was about the 20th Saturday. He went out with Stan Swanson, Ben Fredrickson, his game agent out of Fairbanks, and his son. They went up to set out some caches because he was going to take the Department of Interior chief, I forget who it was then, for a tour of the country up there. And he just dropped off the map one day. He left Peter's Lake, spent the night there, and he never showed up again. So by Monday morning they called everybody, and Sunday they were searching. Sort of casually up there, and on Monday they called an official search, and boy, that was a big one. We had the military DC-4s flying the whole North Slope, checking weather and telling everybody what it was like, and it was good weather, really. It was nice weather. I didn't get in until about Wednesday or Thursday. I found King Salmon, so kind of called me in with a goose, and I searched. I never did search where he was ultimately found.
I think that book said that you came fairly close to it, though. You were in that vicinity.
Yeah,
but
one day we were just south of it. Krupp and I were flying out of Hughes. No, not Hughes. Fort Yukon. Yeah, we were flying out of Fort Yukon. And we were probably 30 or 40 miles away from it. We get assigned sectors to fly, and you just flew that sector. And I don't know who had the one north of us, but from what I saw the pictures, nobody would have ever seen it anyway, because it was burned completely. They might have known scorched ground, but that it was out in the open tundra, and there was nothing there to see, nothing sticking up. The picture I saw, the biggest thing you could see was one of the wheels on the airplane.
No, they found his plane from 21 years.
Yeah, it was, went in 58.
Oh,
let's
see,
I got my computer together.
I think
here.
The book
said
59.
Yeah.
Jeff wanna ask enough over you.
No, this was 59 at this time. It was 58.
Okay.
Yeah, I know it's 58. Because my ex-wife came up there. She was kind of going back and forth. And we rented an apartment here in Anchorage. I went up there and I didn't have any money. She needed money, so I went to the Elks Lodge. They gave me $50 just because I was an Elks member, paid up. And went to Moose Lodge. They gave me another $50 and I sent it back to her here in Anchorage. And I voted in Buttle where we were on the search. And I voted against statehood. That was 1958. 1959, there was another different year. I flew a cabin into, out of on Kodiak Island, I flew a research cabin in, all the pieces and parts in the airplane. I spent a month flying out of Larson Bay. And a buddy of mine, just last year, flying out of there, with the same airplane that I hauled a little garbage in with. Good years.
It also mentions that you spent a night on a Kachemak Bay. Did you sort of get stuck in the mud or something?
Yeah, I was stuck in the mud. Rock stuck in my brake was the biggest part. The wheel wouldn't turn, so I just kept burying in the mud. And I waited until the tide came back in, and then I pulled the gear up, and it was midnight. I called the flight service, and I said, I've got to land in the lake down there. Because I don't dare to land on the runway with this rock locking my brake up. It might put me on my back. So the flight service guy said, we'll have some cars down there and light it up for you. They had several of the people went down and lighted up the road across the end of the lake. That's what I needed to know is where when I cross over the end of that road. Because landing in the water is no problem. But I don't want to land on the hard ground. So I landed there and pulled up in a Muskeg and called them. I said, I'll call you in a few hours. I'm sleeping. I'm going to sleep for a while. And so the next morning, about when I got daylight, I got the rock out of there and started up on back on the runway. It was just one more little deal. So one more little problem would have been, there'd been something.
You were kind of tired after that whole ordeal, I bet.
Yeah, well, it was 4 o'clock in the morning when I finally got it off. And the wind was blowing and I had to keep muzzled into the beach. And it just wasn't anything I could do. So finally, I took off in the dark right out on an island, but it was good strong wind, and I knew that as soon as I left it off, I could roll it over to the left and get the hell out of there. That was one of those little incidents. If one little thing more had gone wrong, it would have been a tragic situation. Nobody was with me, but that was part of the problem. I was all alone. If I had somebody with me, they could have got out of the airplane. I could put it up on the beach, but I had to keep the power on to hold it there. And I tried once to get out of there. And I punched a hole in the float, too. That was another thing that didn't help it any.
Did it take in some water then? And
yeah, the left float was full of water. As soon as I could get it out of the water, though, it'd dump it, it would all leak out. But it still had too much in it. The hole was up forward, and it killed the thing, but it would all drain out.
Sort of weighted you down there.
Yeah, I weighted the left wing down and weighted. I'm uncomfortable. But it was interesting. Nothing ever happened to it. And nothing ever became of it, but.
It could have.
Potentially, yeah. I think back how lucky I was.
Now, what kind of aircraft were you flying with the FAA then?
Mainly DC-3 and C-123. And then other little ones that we'd have charters. Cessna 402 and Air Commander and Mooney. One time I had a Mooney down in Kingstown doing radar, but they were using it as a target for radar to see how much they could see of it. It was such a small airplane, and it was a metal Mooney, not the wooden one. And probably just modern ones.
And that, the C-123, that was a military aircraft that you were flying then?
Yeah. It was given to the FAA in 1956 because the FAA needed something they could haul equipment into the bush with. And DC-3 didn't do it. Didn't have room. So somehow, between the fact we had Jack Jeffords in Alaska and one of his best buddies back in Washington, they put the deal together to buy the 123 for the FAA. It just was assigned to the FAA. And we wore it out. Well, didn't wear it out. Still going. Look, about 19,000 hours on it. Total. I flew it probably 4,000 hours.
You worked pretty closely with Jack Jeffords then?
Yeah, sure did. He was. He was my big brother. I used to go visiting every weekend. And one weekend he died, he just come back from fishing down the Yakutat. Two of his best friends were with him. Dr. Costell and one of the old FAA flight check pilots. Jim Pepper. They were with him in the fishing trip. At the end of the day, they came back home to the cell and Jack was putting his gear away and stairs, and Jack climbed as far as stairs, and when he got to the top, he fell over. And Doc heard him, and he knew what it was. And then Andrews and they hit him many times.
So when did you retire from the FAA?
August 1979. And Dickie Pastor did at the same time. And he went back to factory when they picked up the 123. He really knew that old airplane back. Retired on medical, not on age. I didn't have my 30 years, or I was only 54, in fact, at the time. But with the arthritis, they decided that they ought to let him go, so away I went.
Well, which is it?
On medical, not on age. I didn't have my 30 years, I was only 54, in fact, at the time. But with the arthritis, they decided that I ought to let him go, so away I went.
Well, which aircraft did you log the most hours under?
DC-3. Yeah. Because you're sitting in there and think for 8 hours a day. And you learn a lot of time. You don't do much flying. Well, we did a lot of flight checking, but we could go 8 hours a day in that darn thing. And did it a lot of times, just a lot of it in route. And flight checking. They go to Barrow and you got a lot of in route. We did flight checking in route too, though. We checked airways, checked the radio signal strength and communications, and a lot of different things we could do on the in route flying. It wasn't just flying four of us up the Barrow. But that was a long ways to go. And Pluto was another one that was a long ways.
Which agencies or which one of these employers was perhaps the most exciting or enjoyable?
Oh, golly. Actually, probably Fish and Wildlife was the most enjoyable. BLM was all right, but McCormick and I didn't get along. We did it first, and then later we didn't get along. But Clarence and I were always good friends, and working with him was really a pleasure. And it was less restrictive get there, it was a wonderful job. But I think it was more fun. At first in the FAA with all the electronics, I always played with electronics anyway, and it was really kind of nice. But then it pretty soon kind of got to be old hat. Basically, I'd say my time with Fish and Wildlife, 53 to 60, May of 60 I quit. Because Spader had come along and they wanted to dump all the aviation department of Fish and Wildlife. And later it became OAS, which was a combination of BLM and Park Service and Fish and Wildlife. But they went down to Zilch, they were going to lay us off. And I said, hell with that, I'm going to go out and earn some payment for it and trying to fly a different aircraft.
Which was probably your favorite type of aircraft then?
What?
What was your favorite type of aircraft?
Oh, the Goose.
The Goose?
Yeah, it was so versatile and it was just kind of like my RV at times. And Fish and Wildlife, we were pretty, the old federal Fish and Wildlife, not Fish and Game. We were pretty loose and free. Apparently, if you guys want to go on a hunting trip, get a gang together and go. He liked the fact the airplane was out in the hunting areas. Not that we were doing any enforcement, but the airplane was there. It's like the cops taking the cars home. Nobody knows that the cop isn't sitting in the car watching it. Or just in the neighborhood, they know they got the cop. And we go hunting and fishing and they'll fish and wildlife groups. Now you do that, you go to jail forever.
What was probably your most exciting experience?
Going. I don't know. I wouldn't say there was any one in particular. I don't know. I just can't really
pin
one down.
They mentioned a story in his book about you happened to land on a lake with a bunch of stumps. That were sort of.
Yeah, but there's nothing
the lake.
Scary about that. I knew they were there. That's on the Middleton Island on the east side. There's a lake there. It's full of old dead logs that are sunk at one end and they stick up. Yeah, it wasn't. It wasn't scary. It was just something I wouldn't want to do too often. I did bump on them as I was taxiing in, but they were soft and under water and I touched gently. Yeah, I don't know. I was always chicken. I didn't go so far that scared the hell out of me. I'll go back home and think it over.
How are you still involved in aviation?
Oh, just
you're retired.
A little bit now. Do paperwork for mechanical work I did. And write up 337s and a bit of ultralights, which is the biggest thing nowadays. Ultralights are taking over. Right now I'm fiddling with some scopes and blinker lights for airplanes, like landing lights, have them alternately blink. Built up a little system that doesn't eat up the battery. They got some that are awful hard on the battery, but this one I developed is really easy on the battery and it blinks your landing lights. And I make little parts now and then, but not very much anymore.
Kind of a consultant also?
Oh yeah. Yes, sir, right. Yeah, people call me, I'm awesome, all one of my things that I've done or that I've seen done. Or actually, I've done several things in the Gooses that I developed in landing gear, electric landing gear. It's in most of them now. Parents one day came out that hangar and he says, I want electric gear in that airplane, I'm tired of cranking it. Yep, you do it. So I, every round I found out some outfit back east and fiddled with it and I got some of their information and I developed what is probably 90% of Gooses now have got. It's just electric motor from tail wheel or traction with B-17. We have tons of them, boxes, cans of them. So it was the easy thing to start with. And then found a gear that I could buy to go on a shaft and run the chain from the gear to the motor. And then I rigged up all the electric stops and everything. So and then another thing, I put the first nose door on a goose that flopped forward. The nose doors opened sideways originally. And one of the pilots then, Juno, back in the 50s, said, "We'd sure like to have that door open forward instead of sideways, because you throw the fade out on the side and it bangs in the door and bends it." And the boss says, "Well, see what you can do." So I just got looking at it and riveted two halves together, put a hinge in the front, took some extrusion we had, and stuff started. And what else is? Well, I developed it. Real good fuel gauge for PA-12, which I built about 10 of them and thought I got it all lined up. I got a place that makes the glass for me, and I got another place that does engraving, and nobody buys them anymore. I sold about 10 of them. It's real good gauge. It's better than a PA than Super Cub gauge. Yeah, you skip that up.
I appreciate this wonderful opportunity to learn about your adventurous life. Thank you for your time and sharing your unique and exciting experience.
Yeah.
You know, if you work like a short time,
if you want 10 times?